You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, you're listening to the Food Talk Show with me, Sue Nelson, and Guy Routledge, who's co-founder of Food Rush. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Sue. How are you doing today?
Yes, very good, very good. We're we always like this, don't we? We have got a studio full of stuff to try.
A studio full of lovely people, a studio full of delicious things to eat and drink. And we'll see how we go.
Yes, see how it goes. So we first have as a guest Paul A. Young, who's a chocolatier. What's the French way of saying that?
Chocolatier.
It's sexier,
isn't it?
Reminds
chocolatier is like a chocolate ear.
A chocolate ear. Reminds me of a film I once saw.
Chocolatier.
Oh, that's a good film, that is.
Yeah, it is a good film. Yeah. And we're also joined by Hub Van Bockel, who has got a really interesting energy drink called Tenzing. So we're going to be a little bit stuffed full of energy and sugar today, aren't we?
We're going to be bouncing off the walls. Fortunately, the walls are nicely padded in our studio.
Fine. That's all fine. So Paul, I'm going to start off with you. Very exciting. Your new television programme's been out. Now, I'm afraid to say I haven't seen the first show. I'm really sorry about that. I've got it on catch-up. So don't, you can tell me a little bit, but don't tell me too much.
A bit of a spoiler alert.
But essentially, it's a new TV show, and it's on BBC Two.
Yep.
It's called The Sweet Makers, and it's a three. I love food history. It's a three-part historical food show, looking back at how sweets and confectionery were made in Tudor times, Georgian times, and Victorian times.
Yeah.
And you step back in time. Do you have to dress up?
Full immersion.
So in your first programme on Tudor, what did you look like?
I was asked not to cut my hair or beard for 5 months, so I was incredibly hairy.
Have you cut it since?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
It was huge.
It was big. Voluminous, I think it was big.
There's a bit of a shocking moment in the Victorian episode where the beard actually disappears altogether, which is the first time in 8 years I had no beard.
Oh, wow.
So watch out, everyone. But yeah, the first one's Tudor and Stuart's, which is really as far back as you can go for sugar arriving in the UK and being used in households, I mean, aristocratic households and castles, as a treat. But the amount of work involved just to get it to an edible stage was
huge.
And we were in full costume, and it was January, and there's no such thing as heating in a castle. It was brutally cold, but that's how it would have been.
Yeah,
We had to create... I'll not give too much away to you, Sue, because...
We can give a little bit away. I want to enjoy it on my catch-up.
A little bit. I want to know what's going on.
Okay. Well, we had to clarify sugar. So sugar was very dirty when it arrived in the UK. Mm. So clarifying sugar, making everything from scratch. So if you're pounding almonds for marchpane, which is now called marzipan, you're hand-pounding the almonds, blanching them, peeling them, making comfits, which is taking coriander seeds and fennel seeds, and sitting over a charcoal fire with a panning... tripod and literally doing layer after layer after layer, over 100 layers of sugar to get that little seed the size of an aniseed ball.
Wow.
That's about a 12-hour non-stop process. No sugar thermometers, no whisks, just a bunch of twigs tied up. All of that made things much harder, much longer. I honestly, before we started, and there are three other fantastic confections on the series. I don't think any of us realised when we walked in on that first day. Yeah. Yeah. So we walked in and said, where's all the equipment? And it was there. And there was nothing there. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it must be a very long show then. Or did they speed it up?
I think it's definitely sped up. We filmed for four and a half days. And that's been edited down to 1 hour. But the whole premise of the series is we have to get to a finale, which is exactly what would have happened in all three periods, which was you are making something towards a dinner or a banquet or an event. And they were always show pieces.
So sugar in particular being quite expensive and a treat. This would not be for the masses, would it?
Absolutely not.
There would have been huge swathes of people in Tudor times who would never have tasted sugar ever.
They would never in their whole lifetimes have tasted sweet other than from honey or fruit.
Yeah.
But to have actual sugar, that showed your wealth.
Yeah.
Just having sugar.
So having somebody who would do that, you would take a few days to actually make it the centerpiece, because that's part of proving how amazingly wealthy and influential you are.
It's like somebody buying a really flash car now and they're saying, this is how successful I am. When you come to a banquet, if a four confectioners walk in with a huge centerpiece and they know it's taken days and days or longer to create, then you go, these people are up
there. That's impressive.
You know.
And to put it in context, of course, everybody around that table wouldn't often have sugar.
No.
Very, very rarely anyway. So they would be so looking forward to this. That would be the pinnacle of the meal almost.
Oh, absolutely. And there were things made with natural sugar as well. So medlars were used a lot, which are little fruits that...
The ugliest fruit in the world.
Ugly.
Well, I won't tell you what they...
Can we not say?
Go on then.
Well, I'll use the nicer word, but yes, they are called the bumhole fruit because they do look like a bum. That is the name.
I don't think I've ever seen these before.
Yeah,
yeah. They're very ugly.
But they are ugly, but you have to let them rot slightly so they break down and then cook them down to create like an apple. It's like an apple puree, but very dark, and it sets because the pectin level's very high. But so they used everything, but they used things very seasonally. So that was made into like kind of a jam or could be called like a quince paste, that kind of thing. Quinces were used a lot.
Quince was very sweet as well, naturally.
Yeah, but cooked with a lot of sugar if you can afford it.
Yeah.
But also a lot of marzipan. Things were created with almonds, had almonds a lot, and spices. And luckily, just at the end of the Tudor period, chocolate, the cocoa bean, started to come in, but as a drink. So in no way chocolate as we know it today, but very intense, very strong with spices, quite spicy spices. That really did mean you were up there, that you were wealthy, because who would have tasted sweet chocolate at that period? Only the very, very few.
And that period, we're talking about, what, 1500s, 1600s?
Yeah. Yep.
So we're talking 500 odd years ago.
A long time ago. I mean, we were looking at kind of the food they were eating and how they were eating it at the same time. And it hasn't changed that. What's surprising is things haven't changed as much as you would think. It's just we have better equipment now and a machine to grind down the almonds and to peel them and get them ready. But knowing how to do it all from scratch and how long it takes does catapult you back into today. We could do all of that in a day, whereas it would have taken a team of people. And as confectioners then, you were the elite. You were the best of the best chef-wise, because all of the ingredients were so new.
And you couldn't waste any. I mean, you're talking about almost the stuff that would be more expensive than gold. Almost.
Absolutely. So, well, if you burnt your sugar syrup, you'd lose your job.
Which is very easy to do. I've done it myself a few times.
And without a sugar thermometer in any way, we would, bowls of water, fingers in the bowl, into the sugar syrup, pull it out, into the cold water.
And
to
that's
see
the
how,
way you would...
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
That is amazing.
Got no fingers left. But
you have to be really... Do not try this at home.
No, definitely not.
Thanks for the disclaimer,
You know, watch the next episode and you will see that happening. Like the Georgian period particularly, that's when things got really elaborate. I mean, even my costume as a confectioner was a very dandy affair. And I had to curl my hair. So I had very curly hair. And it was... You felt smart.
Yeah.
I had the whole do on while cooking. Amazing.
And it actually felt very nice.
So I'm presuming
curly hair
then
does sound. Yeah. Sounds makes you look good, doesn't it?
I was going to say, the reason why Hub's saying that is because it's incredibly curly
hair.
So obviously that's the mark of a naturally handsome man, is what you're saying.
Oh, thank you.
Do you know what? I agree. So many people said, I love your hair curly. I haven't bought the curling tongs yet.
No. What a shame. So if we're going to the sort of Tudor times and then we're getting to the sort of Georgian times, the huge difference there, I mean, a couple of hundred years difference, is that there are more people who have more wealth, haven't they?
Yes.
So there's more people can... You still have to be rich, but more people can access and show off.
And people started to open shops, which was rare. A sweet shop or a confectioner shop or a tea shop that also sold comfits and sweets and little cakes. So you could sit down and enjoy it as well. But then it was all about making centerpieces and showpieces that would keep. So you could they were hired out. So if it was your wedding and you had a centrepiece, somebody else might have had that the week before, believe it or not. So they weren't all made to eat. And the centrepiece in the second episode is, it involves, I'll say everything, but it involves a lake of sugar and very sculptural techniques to be able to build this scene that was popular to them, which was leisure. Promenading, strolling, outside, playing croquet, all the
being
pursuits.
Seen.
being seen in the season, particularly. Mm. And actually going, Georgian period, no freezers, obviously, but they had discovered that if you had ice and saltpeter and a bucket and pewter moulds, you could make sorbet and ice cream. And that was some of the first ever opportunity that anyone would have tasted something frozen, which was a revolution and a revelation. Mm. So they were having ices layered up with different flavours in pewter moulds. And we attempted and succeeded with some of them and not with others. But there was a lot of sugar boiling to create spun sugar, to create sugar pieces that were visually astounding to people. How was that made? How was it done? How did they achieve it? And they didn't really want to know how. They just wanted the wow when it walked in.
And is this the thing that you were making, these centerpieces out of like spun sugar? Yeah.
So each episode we start at the basics. What are our ingredients? And we knew nothing until we started filming. The recipes were all original, from original books in original text. And some of them said, take a quantity of sugar and make into whatever it is.
It's a bit like a bake-off then. They do that to people, don't
they?
They do on purpose.
Because you're supposed to know. That the whole thing in Tudor and Georgian, you were meant to know from your peers how to do it. Mm. You were just given a very basic guideline on what you needed, and then you were expected to then know.
And your apprenticeship and your experience would have taught you that.
Exactly, exactly.
So how were these people employed? Would it be like having a resident artist or a resident, I don't know, whatever, that they would actually employ these people because it was a status thing and they would be a permanent employee of that household?
Great question, because some of them weren't permanent. Some did actually come in to, like, as a commission to come and do that particular event. But if you owned a shop, you would be there. Husband and wife team would be there running the shop, making the products. But if you were in a kitchen in a stately home, in a castle, wherever, country house, then you may be permanent if you're rich enough to employ someone as a confectioner, because confectioners were expensive because it was so skilled. Or you would travel and move and do work as you travel through. Yeah, absolutely.
Jobbing confectioner.
Yes, yeah. It's
really
which is still done today.
I'm sure it's still a thing, yeah.
And Victorian times, I mean, not that far away. I mean, if you think... Okay, I admit I'm older than you, Guy, but if you think my grandmother was born in 1898, so she was born in Victorian times, so we're only talking about a couple of generations ago. Huge differences still,
even though it's
100 odd years ago only.
It is massive. The change was astonishing. Automation, mechanics, advertising, marketing.
Advertising, yeah.
The amount of people. But there's a doubt. There's a positive in the early Victorian, which is things were still quite elite and still very revered if you're a confectioner. But as soon as industrialization came in, pre and post the First World War and into the Second World War, it got brutal. So there were a lot of companies having to put illegal ingredients into toffee and chocolate and sweets
to make them out. Just to make it cheap enough for the masses.
And the problem was the big companies like Fry's and Cadbury's and all those big guys were making it harder for the independent confectioner. Yeah. So the independent confectioner was brutally poor, very little money, trying to make ends meet. So one of the techniques was to cook paraffin wax into toffee and fudge.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
And when you all watch the Victorian episode, there is a point where we have to add wax into some toffee and taste it. Don't do that at home, ever, anyone. But you can't tell the difference. And that was that was the reason. Because it was to make money.
But can I say, do you know what? If you fast forward now, it's not actually that much different.
No, exactly the same.
Artificial ingredients.
But actually, it's not about chocolate. It's about meat. It's about ready meals.
Exactly.
It's about, you know, and anybody that thinks that cheap food is okay, it's people have to shortcut because they can't make a living doing it, really.
Absolutely.
And exactly the same thing was happening then.
Absolutely. The commodities have always been expensive. Mm. Cacao, tea, coffee, sugar, etc. At one point, they were very, very expensive. There's one bit in the thread throughout the whole series, which is about sugar and where it came from and the slavery, etc., etc., positive and negative, so it's a very transparent series, very creative. There's a bit of grittiness in there and there's a bit of controversy in there to do with the sugar. But when it comes down to it, it is our love as British people from over 500 years, the joy of sweet things. And that's what it's about and how it's moulded us and how we eat it and whether it's a treat. And then fascinating for me, which we made many thousands of boiled sweets on the Victorian episode with mechanical sweet rollers and things. Now that was fantastic. And we made one of the very first recipes for a fruit pastel. in starch trays, and that was
proper
one was rolls and one was something else, but I can't remember now. But it was boiling gum from, you know, from trees, basically boiling it down, cleaning it, and the process was long. It was so long produce one batch of gums. But right at the end, it's all about advert that we saw the very first advert for chocolate, which was astonishing. It was long. It was like a film. It was only shown at picture houses, and it was for a chocolate bar, and it was a cartoon character of someone, I think, getting run down basically by a car, and saving his chocolate bar, and that made everything better.
Okay.
But it's all about,
I've died, but don't worry.
Yeah, but this will make you feel good. And that's where it comes down to. It makes you feel great. And the last one, we have to stock a sweet shop for Easter. And that's that sweet shop. I mean, it is a shop, if it opened today, would do so well. It's nostalgic.
Sounds amazing.
It's comforting. It smells great. And we did eat a lot of boiled sweets in the process.
Your teeth still look all right.
I have got my own teeth still.
Yeah, well done.
Very impressive.
We're going to come onto your background in a minute, but did you learn actual techniques? Were you thinking, actually, I think I've learned something here and I might put that back into my work?
Boiled sweets. Now, I've grew up with boiled sweets and buying a quarter of something.
Yeah.
That was my childhood. And getting 20
paper bag.
Yeah, paper bag. And after 24 hours, everything stuck to the paper, but you still managed to eat it. All of that.
Just eat
the paper, exactly. Yeah. But all of those, the techniques of making boiled sweets, and because they were very medicinal to start with, they were for coughs and full of herbs and spices. I could imagine if, you know, opening a shop, might be Paula Young Fine Boiled Sweets or something, a sweet shop, and making from scratch naturally. Would work as long as people can see what you're doing and what you're making, because we were all inspired by that. We all loved tasting the boiled sweets at the end, knowing that they were just natural and we just finished them, and it was so creative. The techniques of environment, my business now, we air condition everything because chocolate melts in the heat. But then if it was really cold and really hot, you just had to manage.
To get on with it.
You
had to
get on with it, and you were innovative.
And adjust.
And adjust. Yeah. And say
adjust
what you can
your
do.
Timings.
It's a
adjust
very
everything.
British attitude, isn't it?
Exactly.
Just get on with it.
You have to, yeah. Otherwise,
absolutely.
Your business will just stop.
You can really say, I've got a whole dinner load of people coming. I'm terribly sorry it's too hot in here. I'll do it tomorrow. You can't do that.
No, exactly right.
You've got to pay your rent, and if you're running a shop, or you've got a commission. Yeah. But also, it was how we worked together, and the environment, and the dress, and the clothes, and we were obviously forced by the recipes and the style of the period to make things in a certain way.
Yeah.
So our brains are going, I want to do this, but hang on, I don't have the tools or the facility. Mm. So you have to kind of pull back and go, what can I achieve? And yes, there was frustration between us all because we're all perfectionists. And when you can't reach what you perceive as perfection in your head because you can't physically do it, or, you know, then you've got to kind of, again, readdress and say, right, how can we make this the best we can? Because we don't know exactly how things look. Then there are no photographs.
Ah, of course.
There are sketches, but sketches don't show you the detail or the finish.
But that's where the greatest kind of, you know, creativity and innovation comes from, is when you've got a problem to solve and you go, right, I want to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do it. So I'll try a bit of this, try a bit of that. Trial and error is a great way to discover new things.
Well, look, now we can control heat from a degree to many hundreds of degrees. We had charcoal burners. They're either hot or not. So
either or.
So if it's too hot, it'll burn your sugar. If it's too cold, it won't cook your sugar. And so you have to learn how to man a fire, where now you just turn the dial.
Yeah.
So that right from the beginning was, none of us had lit a charcoal chafing fire before. We're like, okay, so we'll light it. How long does it take? When is it ready? How much charcoal do we keep adding? And we're producing a lot of carbon monoxide at the same time. So all of that was a challenge before you even started to cook or prepare anything.
The really funny thing is that even though you're kind of approaching it from a modern perspective and you kind of know what you want to achieve, you were going through exactly the same kind of learning experience that these people did, you know, 500 years ago. And that's really amazing, especially when you're wearing all the gear as well. It must have felt like, you know, you were reliving
actually
that.
All credit to the production company who didn't set anything up for us, who didn't make it easy for us. They wanted actual reaction. And we were all really, really proud and pleased that was the case.
Mm. You could have said all credit to them, or you could have said that they were really being pretty
mean. I think at the
time... It's got to be real, isn't it? Because they've
got to
see you going through that process.
I mean, I've seen other programmes at wall-to-wall media. You've made like Victorian Bakers, and you watch and you think, how much was really done? Did they really step back and other people step in? No, it was very absorbent. I can't think of the word.
You know, immersive.
Immersive, you know, to the point where we had to think like Tudors. Yeah. And that meant a lot of stopping and pondering and figuring out. And
feels a bit like you need Blackadder.
Oh, do you know what? It actually,
I've had costume, that in my head since we started talking about this and the Prince of Wales and all of his.
My costume in the first one, I did have the knee length kind of bloomer shorts and tights, exactly Blackadder with a little hat and had a Baldric moment.
Baldric moment.
With no turnips involved.
I was going to say a turnip trolley. So let's just talk a little bit about you. So you've got three shops in London, Soho Bank and Islington, and you are pretty much renowned really for being a groundbreaking, inspirational chocolatier, which I'm going to use that word.
Nice.
You've got a reputation, I think, of real incredible creative flavours.
Yeah.
You probably consider yourself as an alchemist in a way.
Yeah, I was very lucky and very privileged to be, in the first year we opened the store, to be named as like an alchemist or someone. The Sunday Times said it has some Blumenthal of chocolate. Because at the time, you could go to every chocolate shop and buy a praline, a caramel, a champagne, the same things. And I was just so frustrated that there was nothing really innovative. And I just thought, we're seasonal in the UK. We've got great ingredients. We've got brilliant micro distilleries, breweries. The chocolate doesn't come from the UK, but what can are the ingredients? And I just admit, I think it was about after 6 weeks, I realised that some of the standard things weren't selling. And that was the point
that you realised.
And I was a product developer before that, so I was used to saying, yes, we can do that. And I thought that was something London didn't have, fresh, unpreserved chocolates with real ingredients. So if it is strawberry, it's real strawberry. But then I thought, well, strawberry's been done forever. What else can we do? Well, if you add Pimm's to it, and then Pimm's has mint and cucumber in, and that became...
So it's real flavour combining for you.
Yeah, my chefs are making recipes. You can make chocolates by buying compounds, flavourings, ready-made reductions and powders and things. That's okay. But for us, it's not okay because we want absolutely fresh is best, pure, unpreserved. They are 7 days. You've got to eat them, enjoy them.
I'm glad you said that because you've given me a box of chocolates here and I have to eat them now.
You have to eat them
right here. I'm mouth-watering. No.
Hub, I didn't say you were going to have
Just to let you guys
any.
Know, we may not get a look in
Hub,
here.
You're just a guest.
Presumptuous
you're
there.
And there's a thing on here and it says best before 20th of July.
Yeah.
This has literally got a day or two.
Because there's no glucose syrup, no sorbitol, no hydrogenated fats, nothing at all to preserve. If it's champagne truffle, it'll last a month because there's booze in it. Mm. And we make champagne truffles with two ingredients only. We take bottles of champagne and blend it into milk chocolate. That is it. Yeah, nice. So it tastes of booze.
Yeah.
And tastes of champagne.
So you're having great fun combining all these ingredients, but at the same time, you're winning all these incredible awards. Mm. And I think, obviously, you were head pastry chef for Marco Pierre White at Quo Vadis.
I was.
And I think that's getting that background of cooking
Absolutely.
And understanding flavours. You just happen to be into chocolate, you are involved in the food sector, aren't you?
Absolutely. I trained as a chef, a savoury chef. Then 6.5 years with Marco, working through the restaurants up to head pastry chef. So I think having chef skills really lends itself to being a chocolatier who uses real ingredients. And my team now use real ingredients. They're not just following a recipe and mixing ready-made things together.
Mm. Yeah, and it's as if winning loads of awards for the taste of it isn't enough. You then have a book, your first book, called Adventures with Chocolate, and you won the world's best chocolate book.
I know.
I love that's an award.
Gourmand Cookbook Awards in Paris. And you're also shortlisted for the André Simon Award, including the top 50 cookbooks. So, you're a little bit of a talented, or just a show-off, which is one of
show-off.
Those.
Show-off. No. I was dragged up, so my mum said, you were dragged up, so just make yourself, get out there, make yourself known. The thing with that was funny, my publisher said, look, we've entered into the Gourmand World Cookbook Awards. You're not expected to win because you're up against people like Auréole Bollinger, Pierre Hermé, et cetera, et cetera. And they were there, and she rang me and said, You should have been here. You've just won. And we had no idea. Literally, it was
incredible.
That very rarely happens.
Yeah.
The great news is that I brought a book out for one of my charities last October, and that's just won the best book chocolate book in the UK and came third in the world in the same awards. So it just shows chocolate is still current.
Yes.
People are still in need of the fascination of it, and the fairy tale of it is still there.
Even though everybody is trying to eat healthy and less sugar and all that kind of
stuff, it's a treat occasion.
Absolutely. And I think it should be.
Affordable luxury. Yeah. Enjoy it. Have it as an enjoyable. Mm. You know, I do eat it every single day, but I'm not saying to people do that. But if you do, have great quality. Then you're not having the artificial ingredients that go into mainstream chocolate.
I also eat chocolate every day, to be honest.
Do you really?
I also think it's not as unhealthy as a sweet, isn't it? It's
just
the cacao.
No. Will eat less of it because it's intoxicating. And
yes, exactly.
The theobromine in the chocolate stimulates the brain, so you get benefits out of it.
Mm-hmm. But I do think it depends on the ingredients.
Absolutely.
If you're pumping it full of, you know, vanilla and sugar, but if you've got really good natural ingredients, they're not going to keep as long. But it's okay.
Exactly.
Now, I've just opened it. You've given me a box. It's very kind of you, Paul. And you can go on to paulayoung.co.uk to find out all about Paul and his chocolates and books and all sorts of stuff. So, look at
her. Give me the box.
I've
got a box and I've just opened it. It's beautifully, beautifully packaged.
Looks like a book.
And it's called the book box.
Looks like a book. So you open it, looks like a book. And in front of me, just calm down. Hold back a minute. In front of me are 16 beautiful chocolates to look at, let alone taste. And they're all sorts of colours and shapes. And some have got little crushed nuts on and different
shapes. There's gold
shapes,
or something
there's
in there
gold
as well.
And there's
Well, chocolate
are red,
is brown.
Some have got fleckles on.
So you have to make it colourful.
Right. Now, you have got no clue as to what these are.
No, so I thought if you all pick one, I will tell you what they
are. Okay, right. So I'm going to pass you over to Hub. I can't because he's almost...
Can I
grab one? No, you can't take the box.
No,
possible. Just pick one.
And I will tell you what it is.
And then Paul will tell you what it is.
The only issue I can see is that there's only one of each. So if you find one that you really like, you can't have a second one.
Then you come back for myself.
So describe that.
Hub has just picked up calamansi, which is a Malaysian citrus fruit. This has been on our collection for 11 years. Wow. From day one, and it's a great summer chocolate. It's acidic, fragrance,
Hub's face.
Full flavored.
Hub, please
makes your mouth water.
I can't wait.
He's having.
I'm
going to
savor the moment.
Mm. I can always hear you. So I can hear you salivating from here.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to go for this little guy. It's like a half circle.
It's very light.
It's very light. Yeah. A lot of chocolates, if they're full of glucose, syrup and fats and things, they'll be chewy and hard and they'll be claggy. We don't want that. You want crisp, clean flavour and texture.
Yeah, no, it's lovely.
So,
Guy, what have you got there?
Guy,
so I've got this kind of half circle, like half a sphere. It's kind of pinky, red, purpley in colour with some gold flecks on it. Yeah.
So this one...
What are we looking at here, Paul?
You are looking at... So I'm the UK California prune ambassador. And this is
he's a man of many titles.
I knew this program would be
world champion.
It is. I don't know how it happened, but it did. Anyway, we've oak smoked California prunes, and we've made a caramel with malt, and then put bourbon in. So it's a smoked California prune, malt, caramel, and bourbon with a 38% milk chocolate from another brand I'm ambassador for, Guitar Chocolate in San Francisco. So the chocolate we use on the outside is milk chocolate made with grass-fed cow milk from Humboldt County.
Just do this the rest of the show. Seconds and thirds. Come on.
We might not talk about 10 cents at all. You don't care. Okay, fair enough. And how does it taste?
Oh, it is good. So smooth. So and it's got like a liquid centre as well.
It has very soft. So there's only one chocolate you have to have, which is in the corner. It's a dark dome.
This one.
Yeah, this is the first chocolate I ever developed.
Okay, so
14 years ago, the recipe hasn't changed, and this is what started the business.
Okay, so this just looks like a dome of chocolate.
It does.
Doesn't look particularly.
It's not decorated.
Exciting.
Not decorated.
Okay, then.
It's understated.
Can I
just
tell you, I had a filling that fell out this week.
Oh no!
I've got a dentist appointment tomorrow. This may well kill me. You might have to drag me off the ceiling. okay.
Do a little
talk. Do I talk? Can I eat this?
So. I'll tell you what
Paul
it is.
Paul is going to talk.
It's a 64% Madagascan shell full of sea salted caramel. And I entered that 14 years ago into the first Academy of Chocolate Awards and it won a gold. And it's won the most awards in the chocolate industry so far for sea salted caramel.
Sue
and it's our biggest
fainted.
Seller. And without it, we wouldn't have the business.
Oh, wow. Well, when did you start?
14 years ago was when I started working and developing chocolate. I opened the first shop 11 years ago.
Okay.
I actually generally like chocolate that much at all. I'm not
sacrilege. You can't say that.
I said not that much at all, unless they're very, very good quality, which you don't get very often. So I've just bitten into that. So there's a hard crust of chocolate on the outside. I know the studio is a little bit hot anyway. Yeah. I've just bitten into that, and then I've just got a little wave of this liquidy ganache type chocolate with beautifully balanced salt in it, I would say, and caramel. Oh, gorgeous.
Thank you.
Blooming good. I wasn't going to eat any more, but should we have some more?
Yes.
If you're listening and you're bored, I'm terribly sorry, but it's far more important that we try these.
Should have been here shows.
If you want to follow along, pause and go and get some chocolate and then come back. And you can join in.
I'm not going to just grab one.
So I'm going to grab you. You have to have this one because I can tell you what's something a bit more unusual.
So can you describe what it looks like? That one that's just dark.
It's a piece of chocolate.
Tiny dark slab.
Tiny dark slab with a bit of colour on it. I feel bad at describing chocolate.
This is a caramel, but there is something cooked into it which creates a sensation at the back of the throat. Mm.
No, it is.
You told me I was going to be here.
Do you know what, Paul Young?
You so got the a good straw, didn't you, to come today? Oh. I mean, you could have been on next week's show.
It's hard to compete,
and you've arrived on the show with Paul.
We get to go pack it every week.
So that one hub is a tobacco caramel. So we've cooked American tobacco into the caramel, and it gives a tingle of nicotine at the back of your throat. And it's a lovely, long, lingering, rich flavour.
Mm. Again, but the very softness is that lingers, but in a nice way, you know? It's not sticky or...
That's so you can eat more.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I've got this one that looks like, you know, those like cornflake things you make when you're a kid
and you get rice crisps.
So it looks a little bit like that. What have I got here?
So this is a Madagascan chocolate rocher. It's got sea salt, pecans, hazelnuts and almonds. It's one of my favourite chocolates. It's crunchy, textural, and it's nostalgic because most people like nuts, like roasted nuts with chocolate. Again, been on the collection 11 years, can't take it off. It's just a classic.
We probably should have checked if you're allergic to nuts before we gave you that one, shouldn't we?
Yes, I'm just about to dive an anaphylactic shock. I love nuts, and you can tell those are pecans.
Yeah, I love pecans.
The problem with, I think, walnuts and cooking walnuts, sometimes they're a little bit sour.
They're bitter, yeah.
These are really lovely. And what's interesting is the salt isn't in the chocolate. The salt is somehow in the nuts, which is really, really nice. And actually, that wasn't too chocolatey. It was very nutty.
So, Guy, you've got something really special. I've got a new one.
It looks, if I was to describe the shape, it's a little bit like a Rolo. You know, kind of like a... obviously, that is sacrilege to say here.
It's a kind of a flat disc.
A flat deep disc. That sounds much better. But there's like some kind of etched into the top of
cocoa
it.
Pod.
Looks like a cocoa pod or a cocoa bean. And it's kind of dusted with this kind of bronzy goldness.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to eat it.
This is... Four Pillars Gin from Australia.
I've
done well here.
Yeah, why haven't I got that one?
It's a good one. With cucumber, pink grapefruit, and coriander seed.
You're looking so smug.
How many chocolates do you have? Do you know every chocolate exactly?
I've still developed them all with my production manager, Nick, and the three production teams make them.
How many total do you have?
Chocolates or people? Chocolates. There are 24 individual chocolates on the collection at any one time. We change half that collection every 6 weeks. Within the store, there's up to 150 products because we have brownies and bars and lots of hot chocolate, ice cream.
And you must have to make them very, very regularly because they have such a short shelf life.
Yeah. Every day.
Wow.
The team are great.
Can you just describe that gin one?
It is amazing.
Bearing in mind, you wouldn't let me have any. So the second best thing is for me to hear what it was like because I'm not going to eat one.
This is the problem with this box. There's only one of each. Really interesting. I mean, normally I wouldn't say that, you know, chocolate and something quite savoury like gin would go together, but it just has that kind of little spiciness that cuts through. I mean, I guess chocolate and spice is a well-known thing.
Yep.
But really, really interesting.
Can I try this one? What is that?
That's lemon tart. It's so... clean,
is it?
Yeah,
it looks like what does it look like?
It's coated in sweet pastry, so like
it almost looks like it's covered in breadcrumbs. Actually,
it's covered in pastry crumbs, very buttery pastry crumbs, and inside is just clean lemon. It tastes like a piece of tarte au citron.
Good. Hub one more. We better end this and talk about you in a minute. Otherwise, we're never going to get round to your products.
I'm going
to
go for it.
I love that. Shall I pick you another? Let's go for something.
Lemon curd.
This one is very, very seasonal.
Oh.
This is totally on trend right now in terms of the season. And it's a scone, strawberry jam and clotted cream.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
I've never seen anybody enjoy themselves quite so much as you, Hub.
I'm used to this. I hear you guys explaining and think, wow, that's so well explained. All I can do is sit back and
I don't know if we're
indulge.
Great at explaining things. We're really good at eating stuff.
Yeah, we're good at
and
eating.
Drinking things.
Mm. I
would say the lemon. I quite like the fact that the lemon wasn't a surprise to me because you just described it.
Yeah, yeah.
What was a surprise is almost like you've got this almost breadcrumby coating.
Yeah.
Which has got a really nice texture around the outside.
It's important to have different textures because chocolate is generally a texture and a crispness and a smoothness, but you have to break it up and so that doesn't become one taste and one texture. Mm. I'm going to give...
Can I have another one? Sorry. Yeah. And I'm sorry.
Which one would you...
This probably isn't making a very good programme.
we have. In the box, we only have
we're all
two.
Very happy.
We have eight left. And
OK, well, one more, guys. That's all. And then we'll have to eat them in the break.
So alcohol or no alcohol?
Alcohol, please.
Oh, pass that round, please. That was very quick.
It's very, very, very quick. Well, I didn't want Guy to have this and one.
I can't have all the booze.
There we go. So, see if you can guess what that is.
Oh, God, here we go.
Oh, we have talked about it briefly already.
I'm going to guess champagne.
It was champagne.
It is. Just champagne and chocolate.
Amazing.
Nothing else. There's no milk added, no cream added, no sugar.
Now, when you get a chocolate liqueur and it's got alcohol in all...
Yeah.
Even I've tasted quite a few champagne truffles, which I've been hugely disappointed by.
Yeah.
Stuff full of sugar and you get that horrible, crusty...
Oh, I hate the crust. Yeah, it's very
crusty sort of.
It's an old-fashioned way of doing it, but it's where you have a filling that is made out of a very dense sugar syrup, usually with not a lot of champagne or liqueur in it. So it actually naturally crystallizes on the outside, then it gets enrobed in chocolate. Or you make a shell that then the syrup crystallizes inside, and then you can enrobe it or fill it. I don't make any kind of liquid liqueurs like that, but if I'm making a whiskey chocolate or a champagne, it's made with a lot of the whiskey. There's usually water or cream in there as well, but it's then balanced with the chocolate, but still very soft and very silky. But I'm
That's
not a fan.
Almost of... slightly bubbly.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
We can't keep the bubbles, unfortunately.
But there has a slight.
The alcohol content is still there fully.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's brilliant. I love that word enrobe.
I love
enrobe
the
chocolate.
Yeah.
Right, come so on then, quickly.
Last one.
Right, last one. I'm looking at this thing. It's kind
food
of.
Things in
we'll talk about that in a minute. It's green. It's got like a yellow splash of colour across the middle of it. It looks like a nut.
It's a cocoa pod.
It's a cocoa
well,
pod.
Well, a tiny little cocoa
a tiny
pod
little
shape.
One, yeah.
In
Let's
colour,
see what's inside.
In this is quite tropical. There's a clue.
I'm thinking pineapple in there.
Thinking coconuts, maybe?
No. It's fruit. Very fruity.
There's
it's a fruit. It's a fruit I actually don't like to eat on its own, but I like it in chocolate.
Passion fruit. No.
There is a passion fruit chocolate in the box.
No, we're not allowed to eat anymore.
The chocolate is so good that it's kind of it's a bit spicy as well. There's a bit of something in there.
Yeah, there is. It's Alfonso mango and chipotle chili.
Ooh,
that's a favourite combination for
that
you.
That is nice. Yeah. I was going to say mango, but then I didn't want to get it wrong because I'm supposed to know about food. But it's good. Really,
Can you
really
get a bit
good.
Of chili there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chipotle is great because it's deep and
it's
warm,
smoky,
but not hot and smoky. Yeah.
That is very,
great
very good.
Chocolate.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about your chocolates afterwards, but we really do need to speak to Hub.
We do, because I've got something exciting in front of me.
And so have I, although Hub looks like he just wants to hurry on with the
Move
chocolate.
Them away.
I'll be totally fine with that.
You'll be totally fine with that. Okay, so we're going to have a break for a couple of minutes, and then we'll be back talking to Hub van Bockel about Tenzing, and we'll carry on talking to Paul A. Young, who is... We all agree, I think, around
friend.
This table is our new best friend, and who is an incredible chocolatier. So we'll come back and talk to him there. In the meantime, we're going to go over to speak to Rim from Miro, I think it's called, who makes vegan ice cream.
Hello, it's Harry at the Allergy and Free From show on the last day, the Sunday. It's very warm, very busy, and there's one stand in particular which is getting a lot of attention because it's selling some ice cream, ice lollies, and that is Miro. And I'm here with the founder, who is Rim, and she's here to tell me a little bit about the product. So thank you for coming on the show. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're doing at the Allergy and Free From show?
Hi. So we launched 4 months ago, and we really wanted to get some exposure and to put the product out there in front of customers. So our product is vegan, free from gluten, refined sugar with like 175 calories. So it really fits with the theme here, which is allergy, but also veganism. So this is why we came here, really, to get some exposure.
So I came over to your stand early and it looked like you was making quite a lot of money through sales as well. Is for a company like yourselves who's fairly new, is coming to the Allergen Freeform show, is it more for sales or is it more for brand awareness and hopefully to meet a buyer or something like that?
For us, it's more for brand awareness, really. This is our top priority because we are brand new and a lot of people discovered the brand over the weekend. And otherwise, it's also to get some contacts and really to talk to people, really.
And in terms of the product that you've got, obviously you've mentioned it's free from, it's basically a lot of good. Do you think that obviously with people finding out more and more that they've got these intolerances, these allergies, that the market's only going to go sort of one direction?
Well, I think that people are very innovative today with marketing, and they really marketing gets really personal. It's really how the message they want to convey and to get out there. It's no longer the type of messages huge industries wanted to convey in the past. Like, they really have their own personal message. And this is what Miro is as well. It comes from Latin, which means to wonder. And we really wanted to offer a product people, or vegans, or people who want to have, like, healthy treats can wonder about. So we had, 2.5 years of R&D to be able to manage to get this product, because it's the first vegan ice lolly that is free from dairy and but also soya, and our message really is summer. We want to convey a positive vibe, something summery, fun, and this is really how people sense the marketing here. So it's really there are so many ways to convey a message, and this is the type of position we got, something very fun and playful.
I mean, you mentioned R&D there. I guess it's taken quite a lot of time, obviously, where you are the first to go down that route. I guess it's taken quite a lot of time and quite a lot of testings to make sure that the product was absolutely right.
Yes. So I'm personally extremely picky. This is also my personality. So I wanted to work with the best people. So I traveled a lot around the world to find the right people, really. I'm very hands-on, so initially I really created the product for myself initially. I wanted to cut on sugar, to go dairy-free, and when I saw the feedback around me, my family, friends and people I didn't even know really pushed me to share it with a wider audience. So I was patient with R&D because I knew that the demand out there was here and people were looking for this type of product, as I was as well. You really have to surround yourself with the right people for that.
And I mean, in terms of us being at the allergy show today, I was having a look at the statistics before we came along, and basically the visitor numbers just increased year on year, and obviously that's just through people knowing more about, having more education about it, more background. So in terms of sort of your company going forward, is it a case of trying to become the best ice cream in sort of the vegan free from category, or is it that you'd actually quite like to sort of challenge the Magnums, challenge all the sort of the supermarket brands as your competition?
So to be honest, we don't compare ourselves to Magnums. I think they are a different product and they have different type of customers, and what we really want to get is really to create a subcategory on its own. Basically the idea also is to have fun, I would say. It's a journey and we really want to have fun. We really want to offer great product that tastes awesome to people who are vegans or who want to lead a healthier lifestyle. We don't have the pretension to become the next Magnums. I think it's two different products, two different customer base. But we just want to have fun and to have as many people as we can who would get on board in this adventure with us.
Absolutely. Well, it looks like you're having fun today as well. So where can people find out more information about the company?
So you can go on the website, www.miro.co.uk. Otherwise, we are quite active on Instagram as well. So Miro Ice Cream.
And that's always important as well, being active on social media.
Yes, when you start, when you start up, definitely. I think it's very important. We really try to answer to every single comment, because this is basically the marketing position we adopted, like being very close to people, having like the dialogue, getting the feedbacks on board, and I think social media is the best way to do that.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, good luck at the show, and let's hope to see Miro more in the future.
I hope so too. Thank you very much.
There we go. That was Rim talking about vegan ice cream. And here we are back with Hub Van Bockel and Paul A. Young. Hub, we're going to talk to you for a minute. And any reflections on chocolate?
I feel so lucky. I'm a big chocolate fan, and here I'm with the world champion, chocolate bestseller, maker. Ambassador of ingredients. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Yeah.
But whilst we would still love to taste even more chocolates, shall we actually talk about you? Because you are one of our guests as well. Mm-hmm. I have a can in front of me of something called Tenzing Natural Energy, which is something that you've produced. Mm-hmm. Before we talk about that, can you just tell me a little bit about Red Bull? Because you used to work there for a while. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about the brand? And it was something quite different at the time. And what did you learn while you were there?
What do you think about the brand Red Bull?
Yeah.
I think it
was different at the time, you must admit.
Different, what do you mean?
In terms of being some type of energy drink, awake and all that. It was quite groundbreaking.
It was, definitely. So I was there for 8 years and I started about 10 years ago. So I was there when it was already quite big, not as big as it is now. But I remember when I drank it for the very first time when I was a student, and it was in Holland what people do a lot of things that are kind of illegal in Holland, but still drinking that first ever Red Bull. We were in our house, so we lived with 12 guys in one house, and someone had bought one and no one dared take the first sip. You know, that's how extreme it was at the beginning. Yeah. You know, Red Bull's like, oh my God, people have, you know, it's forbidden in this country and people have died there of it. And there was this whole, I don't think there was ever, that was very positive. You know, I think times have changed now. Just talking about vegan ice cream and, you know, so
and healthy chocolate.
And especially when you're a student or young, you did not care at all about your health. And I think that, you know, it just fits it so well in that time, and in, you know, the energy, it was also, you know, very about the dance scene at the time was coming up, and, you know, so I think it was, you know, the timing and the product were just amazing.
Yeah, and I think what something like Red Bull have really captured, which some of the vodka brands have done as well, is that they've really understand that experiential marketing the way to actually sell these products.
Exactly. You could even basically say pioneered it a bit, I would say. Yeah, I think the Marlboro before, but, you know, how Red Bull did it was just, you know.
And experiential being, you know, running events or you know, dance things or whatever, and actually mixing the brand in with people turning up and doing things.
Exactly. And it was all own platforms, you know, so they would never sponsor anything. It would literally be the Red Bull Air Race or and I think it was really cool. So when I joined, it was still kind of small enough that you'd meet the founder and owner.
Yeah.
And he basically said at the time, this was more than 10 years ago, you know, we kind of missed the boat when it comes to digital and online. And he said, we have to speed that up. And, you know, the rest is kind of history.
They have their own creative agency now.
Yeah, they have all their own stuff. So, you know, he's just a very, you know, visionary man.
And with your background there and at Unilever, and also you became a marketing manager for MTV.
Yeah.
So you're really into the sort of funky, you know, I know you like chocolate, but you're really into the sort of understanding how you mix social media and targeting very specific groups in order to get your product sold.
Exactly. Yeah, I was. I went from Unilever to MTV, and at MTV, I was actually responsible for the first ever social media, even before Facebook was around. Mm. It was just that those ID pages, you know, I mean, might remember them, where you just had your picture. That's how Facebook started as well.
Yeah.
So there was no walls or no real chat. It's just like, this is who I am. This is how much I, whatever. This is how I look. And but it was really interesting to be at the heart of that and see how fast it's developed.
Really interesting.
I wrote a book on the topic as well. It's called The Social Brand.
You wrote a book called Social Brand. I've written a book called Naked Marketing. Have you written a book?
I have, but it's a technical subject, which is probably not that appropriate here.
These guys have written proper books.
They've written proper books, yeah.
They've written real proper books. Yeah. So you've got all this sort of social media background and obviously real understanding of energy drinks. Mm-hmm. What possessed you to do Tenzing? Was it that search for something natural as opposed to...
Yeah, it was, you know, and I think it was such an interesting talk, hear you talk also about the history of things. And I think, you know, what's happened now, especially that story about where the big players had all the market share, you know, back in Victorian times, and the smaller ones had to use wax or cheaper stuff. And funny enough, now that's kind of turned around.
Yeah.
So the big guys, they just obviously have to look at their, you know, and you know, it's the easiest way is to make more profit is to cut stuff out of your product and use artificial ingredients. And now the other guys like a Fever Tree and or someone like myself comes in and says, no, we shouldn't be using these ingredients. We should use like proper ingredients and people that are sourced from a specific place that we know where, because people have just become a bit wary, and rightly so, of all the stuff that are being put in. I've actually got a really great story on that I had to think about when I was at, I can't say the name, but it's pretty obvious because you just mentioned it, but I was at a company, a big one, and they had just started, and we were going to launch a margarine with strawberry flavour. So it was meant to be...
Strawberry margarine, what on earth for?
It never made it.
To go on your scones, obviously.
But the funny story was, nice I was just, I think it was probably one of my first months ever, and it was just trying to get into not only being a spread, but also being like, you know, the final product. So you didn't have to put anything else on your bread anymore. Yeah. And we were all kind of, you know, tasting it. And everyone said, well, it doesn't really taste like strawberry. It doesn't really taste. And then someone said, have we tried with actual strawberry? And no one had even thought about it.
You know what? That makes me so depressed.
I know, but that's how it works. It is genuinely true.
And it is
so we're all opening our Tenzing. Sorry, do carry on.
No, I was just going to say it is strange now that it's the small brands who are, you know, they're trying to go back to the roots, back to natural, back to you know lower sugar or healthier whatever it is to try and do something different and
exactly
like, you know.
And it's also partly because you know they can't really. I would nearly say you have to forgive them in some sense. Like if you think about the likes of Coke, they're not meat. They when they launched. You know, we're talking about sugar before, you know, when they launched in 19th century, people wanted sugar, you know, and people, and it was like an energy drink back then.
It was luxurious,
you know, and when you say, talk about sugar and, you know, it's also the reason why it is so popular now. It's not probably like the flavor, but also because it was posh once and it's something that's posh once always kind of trickled down. So we all want it, you know, and I think, but now these companies are stuck with their brands and products. And it's very hard all of a sudden for like someone to like Coke to say, we're going to take out half the sugar because it'll taste very different.
I met somebody who's an innovation, whatever they call them, inside PepsiCo. Mm-hmm. She has to come up with 100 new product ideas like in a week.
Crazy.
That's just like...
That's why it's not very innovative.
Yeah.
They're all the same.
I think most of the big guys have kind of... to the fact that I've been in both, right? Started my own business and worked for bigger companies. And it's just a different skill set. You know, it's a different, like I was at Red Bull for a long time, even when it wasn't, well, you know.
They're fantastic at marketing because they just know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. And look, if I'm honest, Red Bull probably would have been, I was head of marketing for UK and Europe, so quite a good job, but it probably would have done quite well without me, you know? So I think these big brands are very good at nurturing, you know, stuff. Yeah. It's very different than launching your own thing. And they just realize more and more that they can't really do it.
Yeah.
And so they're looking kind of, they look at more innovative little brands and usually tend to buy them.
Yeah. So in this energy drink, which I just had a slurp of, we've got real natural ingredients, which is your thing, really. Yeah. And you've come across this natural energizer of the Sherpa people. Mm-hmm. I presume that's why it's called Tenzing. Mm-hmm. And it was a stimulating brew used for decades to fuel expeditions on Mount Everest. And this brew not only inspired the key ingredients, but obviously inspired the name. Mm-hmm. Chosen in honour of Sherpa Tenzing Norgay. And since then, you've been trying to, I don't know, refine it, I would say.
The actual...
From the, you know, from the original...
It was very refined. I left Red Bull, and all I wanted to do was launch something that was natural and lower in sugar.
Yeah.
And then it was one of those classic, you know, just, you know, it took longer than I thought it would, you know, to come up with the right recipe. I had a nutritionist that was helping me. And in that time I was traveling, and then someone actually told me about what the Sherpas drink. And they drink a really strong tea with salt, and actually they add butter. So the tea, the strong tea is like the caffeine, and then the salt is to keep it hydrated, and the butter they use like as their carbs. So I spoke to my nutritionist about it and I said, is this a cultural thing or does it actually make sense? And funny enough, normally in the markets in the UK or globally, it's either you got your caffeinated drinks or your drinks with electrolytes.
Yeah.
But it actually makes quite a lot of sense to have them together because caffeine is a diuretic, so it doesn't help you maintain your fluids. And that's why they use it because, you know, in those heights, you need a bit of caffeine, you need a bit of, you know, the electrolytes to keep you going. And then that kind of inspired the two main ingredients for me. And then I thought, Tenzing, which I was always a big fan of, would be an amazing name, because obviously Zing is energy and Tenzing. Yeah. And not everyone knows him, which I think is nearly a good thing.
So he was one of the first people to climb Everest, right?
Together with Edmund Hillary, he was the first one on top of Mount Everest.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it was also quite a cool story, because then I kind of, first of all, I looked if it was still available, the name. And it was. And then I had to kind of, and then I wanted to also contact the family, because it's apparently not needed. Because Tenzing is just like Jack in Nepal. So I managed to find his kids, who are now in their 50s, and you know, got in touch with them, met both of the sons, and you know, we work closely together now, actually.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. What's your thoughts on this, Paul?
Well, I'm not a fizzy drinker.
I'm not particularly.
I haven't been. And this I haven't had caffeine for 18 years.
Oh, dear.
Paul will be bouncing off the walls.
Well, I have
a lot. Chocolate.
There's a little bit.
There's quite a lot of chocolate, isn't there?
There's a bit, but
is there
there's
a first
more...
aider outside the studio?
There's more theobromine in chocolate. So I haven't actually had like a caffeinated drink for about 18 years, which is really odd. But I can't stand the smell of a lot of energy drinks. It's the smell
awful,
that puts me
they?
Off. But this actually tastes kind of fruity and strawberry and kind of light. And it's not too fizzy.
Yeah.
It's just sparkling rather
than... And that's a difference for me.
It's a big difference, because I don't like that intense fizz. But this actually doesn't leave that weird acrid aftertaste at all. It's the aftertaste the same as the taste
I can
beginning.
Definitely taste a little bit of salt in there as well.
Yes. and a little bit of salt is nice, because it takes the sweetness down a little bit.
Yeah.
So we've got, so we've got green tea, green coffee, guarana, lemon juice, beet sugar, and a little bit of rock salt.
Yeah. And the interesting bit is around the sugar levels as well. Sorry. Is that it was also smooth speaking, because at the end of the day, when you have to formulate a product that goes like on a bigger scale, you have to talk to these flavor houses, because they have to put all the ingredients together. And I spoke to a lot of them, again, that work for all the big guys as well as the smaller ones. And I said, I want to take out half the sugar, and at least, you know, because I want to hit that 5 grams of sugar, because that is, you know, it's isotonic. It actually is better for your energy levels, as opposed to going really high up. And then, so the, usually like a Coke or Red Bull would have 11 grams of sugar per 100 ml, and this has 5. All of them said, okay, you want to take out half the sugar. What do you want to replace it with? And I said, nothing. I just want to take it out. Mm. Has no one ever asked you that before? I said, no one has ever asked them that before. So this is how the whole soft drinks industry just works. They take something out and they put something in, because they think that people expect a certain level of sugar. But I think that, you know, sugar, it's like what happened in crisps, when the salt just, when they slowly started taking the salt out. And if you'd have a crisp now, or Walkers of 10 years ago, you go, oh, that's very salty. And I think that the palate will change more kind of light. You know, funny enough, the sweetness you can still kind of get, but it's the syrupiness that you can't.
So
it's sweet enough.
It's sweet.
It's perfect for me.
Exactly. And it's not as syrupy, so you don't leave. It's a bit like the chocolate. It's there, but there's no stickiness. And it's partly because of the natural ingredients, but also because of the lower sugar levels.
Well, I can't believe we're actually running out of time.
Oh no.
I know. Just tell me a little bit about your marketing, though. I mean, you're very good at marketing, I think, Paul. But I think you base yours basically on reputation, quality. You know, you can't get better than this, because we're really, really good at what we do.
Never pay for marketing, but if you've got a product that speaks for itself, and then people who speak about it, that's how we've used that marketing tool.
And you're lucky to have, but a part of the plan is you've got the shops, obviously. This has to compete in an incredibly, crowded space. Mm-hmm. How are you doing with that? You should be amazing with your background.
Yes. Funny enough, someone asked me the other day, because I've come from a marketing background, so I had to do everything now, products, you know, the development, the sales, the logistics. And someone asked me, what's the most difficult? And I said, the marketing. Because, you know, it is, you know, so different to having budgets of, you know, sky high to like nothing. So it's actually, it's exactly the same what Paul does. We work together with partners, because we don't have our own shops.
Yeah.
So it's about being in the right shops, or in Whole Foods, or Planet Organic, Holland & Barrett, and Selfridges, you know, so basically seeing, so that people see it in the right environment, and then also kind of, you know, they believe it works and believe it's natural, which is important for us, because, you know, energy drinks is so connected to artificial that we really have to, you know, show them and tell them that it's not.
And you're doing a lot of that experiential marketing as well. I was on your website earlier, and it was funny that I looked at the site and then I read the research, and when I was looking at the website, I was thinking, oh, this is kind of similar to Red Bull, with all the adventurousness and, you know, sending people out with GoPros if they, you know, say they're going on a trip somewhere, you give them a load of Tenzing. And then I read the research, like, used to work at Red Bull. It's like, you know, yeah, it's all come full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're actually done. We're doing that. I still got to update my website, to be honest. But we're doing that less now. We're just talking more about the product. I think that's also the key. The interesting thing is, like, someone like Coke and Red Bull and Lucas, they can't talk about the products anymore because they can't say, look, we make this in a lab somewhere in China. so we actually now only talk about the product. And that's what, like, the Fever Trees have done. And so you can just basically say, these are the ingredients and this is how it works. Yeah.
Well, fabulous. We hope you know, this goes really well. I wish you good luck with it. If you want to find out more about it, you need to go on to teamtenzing.com, and Tenzing spelt T-E-N-Z-I-N-G, so teamtenzing.com. And thank you so much for allowing me to taste your chocolates, Paul.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a joy to be here.
paulayoung.co.uk if you want to find out about those. I feel a bit, I feel a bit sort of floaty high
stimulated.
Now.
I need to finish your energy drink and then we'll go out and have some lunch.
Absolutely. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show with me, Sue Nelson, who's now chocolated right up, and my fellow presenter Guy Routledge. You can hear our show on numerous radio stations. There's too many to mention now, isn't there? I syndicated all over the place, from California to the Kent coast, Manchester to Michigan, and even in Malta now. If you want to download any of our hundreds of podcasts, please go to foodtalk.co.uk. Or if you want to, I said this last week actually, if you want to tell me how amazing I am, please tweet me. Or if you want to say that, you know, really Guy should, you know, I don't know, improve his technique. You can tweet us at foodtalkshow.co.uk. And thank you so much for listening. And I hope we didn't trouble you too much by eating chocolates all the way through. And we really look forward to catching you next week.
See you next time.
Bye.